This is Chris McGrath, Keeneland Life's Work Oral History Project, Seth Hancock.
You ever see me around these sales wearing short pants, you better run for cover because the world's getting ready to come to an end.
Seth Hancock is remembering Swale. Bittersweet animal. He slaked Claiborne's ancestral thirst for a Kentucky Derby, trained by the great Woody Stevens. A week after Swale added the Belmont, Hancock was back in New York to see one of the farm's fillies run in the Mother Goose.
And I went over to the barn. It was, you know, a nice late spring day in New York. He was standing there, head out over the web, and breeze blowing foretop. Looked like the happiest horse on the face of the earth. Came home that night, and Woody called the next morning and said, "You sitting down?" I said, "Well, yeah, what's going on?" He said, "Swale dropped dead this morning, Seth."
The whole saga comes flooding back. How his late father, the force of nature that was Bull Hancock, had raged when one of the best Claiborne mares not only delivered another damn filly, and so prolonged the wait for a Derby colt, but a filly with one eye. How Tuerta, Spanish for one-eyed girl, was retained only because she had become the last stakes winner in his father's name. And how her yearling colt, by Seattle Slough, had gone missing from a paddock one misty morning. They figured he must have jumped the fence. They called and hollered, and eventually found him asleep, overlooked in a swale. That was the kind of horse he was. All the hoopla of Derby Day was never going to bother him. The joy Hancock felt when Swale exorcised the farm's Derby curse was not so much on his own account. At 35, he hoped he might yet get another shot someday. But he exulted for his mother. After all those years of Derby disappointment and frustration shared with Bull, and also for his wonderful partners in the horse. Now, out of a clear blue sky, Swale was gone forever. He would never become another Bold Ruler, or Nazrullah, or Prince Quillo. Never become the next link in the chain forged by his father and his grandfather before him.
You're like, damn, you know. What am I doing in this thing here? I mean, this might be a little rough, but what the hell? I ain't the first one that was dealt a bitter pill, and I won't be the last. For sure, I haven't been the last, and it's just like you said, it's this game. And Leroy Jolly said it best, this game wasn't meant to be played by people wearing short pants.
The irony, of course, is that Hancock had himself barely been out of knickerbockers when finding himself at the Claiborne helm, following the sudden death of his father in 1972. He was, in fact, just 23, 6 years younger than his brother, Arthur, whose wild youth had notoriously so alarmed the powerful estate advisors that he soon left to be his own boss on a small parcel of leased land. Arthur's triumphs at Stone Farm, not least a Derby success 2 years before Swale, are well chronicled, but the younger brother had always kept his head down, both as he watched Arthur's at times turbulent relationship with their father, and when this tragic void had opened at the heart of Claiborne.
I mean, I saw the mistakes that he made and where it got him. I said, well, I'm not going there. And, you know, when Daddy passed, Arthur was running and gunning, and you thought, well, this will be a sobering effect on him, and he'll realize he can't do that anymore. And truth be told, he really didn't realize it by his own admission.
He is gratified by Arthur's reformation since, and by his reconciliation to the way things played out to their mutual benefit. But it wasn't easy at the time.
He had his area of responsibility. I had mine. And I guess we were doing all right, but we also had an advisory committee that we had to run big decisions by, which was fine with me. I mean, I was 23. Hell, I certainly didn't have all the answers, but he was 29. And I guess he figured he did have all the answers, and he didn't want to do it. And he made a couple of decisions that he didn't run by him, and they kind of called him on him, and he, in short order, said, I've had enough. I'm done. And he left, and that was that.
So here was the younger brother, charged with replacing two of the modern turf's greatest patriarchs, Bold Ruler, who had died the previous year, and Bull Hancock himself. All through his upbringing, the horsemanship had always been merely shown rather than taught, yet now he had to transform himself from learner to leader.
But it was never, you know, son, look at this, look at that, look at this, look at that. I was in the Army Reserves, and I got out in December of 71, and he had a program set up for me, kind of a two-year apprenticeship. And then, of course, September the next year, he passed. So that kind of went out the window.
He had completed the first stage with the broodmare foreman for the 1972 breeding season and had embarked on stage two, the breaking cycle with the yearling manager, when his father fell sick grouse hunting in Ireland. Within weeks, he was dead.
It's like, I guess, if you got somebody in a boat and you throw them overboard, they don't want to die, so they learn how to swim. And, you know, I mean, I knew all the guys on the farm. Hell, I'd been around there ever since I was a kid, and I had a good rapport with all of them. And one thing about being young, I guess in a lot of ways it's a disadvantage, but in other ways it's an advantage because you don't ever think you're going to fail. You know, I think if you're 40 and you make a decision, you stop and consider what happens if this doesn't work. When you're 23 and you make a decision, there's no thought that it ain't going to work because you just figure, hey, I'm bulletproof.
But while Hancock had the humility to know his limitations and was grateful for the seasoned counsel available to him, he also had to make his mark to show himself equal to the authority abruptly vested in him. And the next thing he knew, he was supervising the syndication of a champion two-year-old. The parting bequest of Bold Ruler, horse name of Secretariat. Hancock reiterates his debt to the old hands who shared the tiller early on, like those of William Haggin Perry.
I'm not a person that has tremendous confidence, so, you know, I mean, I was very glad. I mean, Mr. Perry called me when Mr. Chenery died. And he said, Seth, Chris Chenery died. And I said, well, I'm sorry to hear about that. And he said, you're going to have to come over here for the funeral. And I said, what do you mean? I didn't even know the man, Mr. Perry. And he said, no, you need to come over here because the state is probably going to have to sell some assets to pay for estate taxes, and one of them's liable to be Secretariat.
Well, if Perry thought that was what he should do, that's just what Hancock would do.
So I flew over there. I'll never forget it. It was cold as hell. It was in January. We went to the funeral, and he gave me a pair of gloves, which I've still got, and in it it's stitched William Haggin Perry. And, you know, he said, now look, you be sure and tell Penny that you're ready, willing, and able to syndicate the horse if, you know, if that's something that they think they might want to do. Well, hell, about a month later, or probably 6 weeks later, she called and said, I'm coming to Lexington with my lawyer, and we want to get together with you and Gail Mooney and talk about syndicating Secretariat. And I said, yeah, that's great. We went to the coach house over there, and we talked about it, and I had a cocktail napkin there and a pen, and I wrote down the details on the cocktail napkin, number of shares, price per share, how many they were keeping. I mean, I was being coached up. I had been coached up by Mr. Perry. If he had rolled craps and he had a bad three-year-old year, it probably would have been the end for me.
Even so, Hancock modestly demurs that he had any kind of personal stake in the epoch-making Triple Crown campaign by which Secretariat made even a record syndication look smart business. If anything, he suggests, the deal should be credited posthumously to his father through the relationship he had forged with the Chenerys. Yet the fact was that there was a whole lot of legacy at stake. Everyone had lost a father. Hancock, Penny Chenery, Secretariat himself. Bull Hancock had always told how the sale of Round Table, before the death of his own father, paid the estate duties and saved the farm. Sure enough, knowing the difficulties that would follow his own exit, He had left instructions that the yearlings be sold commercially.
Because racing's a risky business, and I mean, you might go 5 or 6 years and lose money every year, and then a 49er comes along, or a pulpit comes along, or a swale comes along. But if you go too long before that one comes along, you might be out of business. And he couldn't have known whether we were going to sink or swim. And selling yearlings would give you more time to learn how to swim. The machinery that he left behind there with Nijinsky, Survivor, Damascus, Buck Passer, Forley, Drone. I mean, we had a roster of stallions that it would have taken you 10 years to ruin, you know, but got lucky right off the bat, and Secretariat came in there, and, you know, and then we were able to kind of keep adding some stallions and do okay. And then, of course, got Danzig and Mr. Prospector came there in 80, and they carried us for a long, long time. And about the time they were kind of getting old, and here comes Pulpit, and about the time he was getting old, here comes Warfront, and now he's getting old, and hopefully Run Happy or somebody else is going to pick up the ball and run with it.
Danzig and Mr. Prospector doing okay. Yet one very nearly started in New York, and the other, of course, did start in Florida. Hancock remains indebted to Peter Brand for the transfer of Mr. Prospector, a turning point for the modern breed.
Well, any form of athletics that you fool with, speeds is a precious commodity, and he had it in abundance, and he threw it into his offspring. If you've got speed, you go in with an edge, in my opinion. And I mean, he'll get you a grass horse, he'll get you one run long, he'll get you anything.
As for Danzig, he was all about Woody Stevens. With such an abbreviated track career, the horse looked a tough sell in Kentucky and was actually destined for New York until his trainer insisted that Hancock come up to Belmont and meet with Henrik de Kwiatkowski in the trustees' room.
Woody said, you know, you better take this horse. He's the fastest horse I ever trained.
Hancock protested that he couldn't get close to the kind of money required.
I can't come close to that kind of money. And Woody looked at me and said, what can you do, Seth? And I said, I probably can sell 40 shares for, I think it was $80,000 a share. And Henrik stuck out his hand. He said, you got a deal.
Hancock is palpably moved as he recalls the indispensable Stevens.
Greatest trainer that ever lived, in my opinion. He taught me more than anybody. And he took time to teach me. I mean, whether it was our horse or another horse, Woody said, let me show you this. You know, a tendon or puffy ankle or a buck shin or whatever. And not only was he somebody that was a mentor to me, he was also a really good friend. And I'd have never made it without him.
The long-standing relationship between Claiborne and Coolmore introduced him to another horseman of genius in Vincent O'Brien, who had trained Sir Ivor and Nijinsky.
He'd walk up to him and kind of look him in the eye and might kind of say something, and you realize that they're going to say something to him they wouldn't say to somebody else, you know. It's just a touch, a feel. Some guys have it, most guys don't.
Fortunately for Hancock, he too discovered an innate intuition as he sought to refine the families cultivated by his father and grandfather. For there were no hard and fast rules. After losing his father, Hancock went back over the matings book, looking for a pattern. He noticed how big mares, like Face the Facts and Moccasin, had been bred to a neater type, like Round Table. So he figured he knew what was happening there, a quest for athletic balance. When it came to a big stallion like Unbridled then, Hancock paired him with smaller mares, and it just never worked. He still thinks the principle is right. In a similar situation, he'd do the same again. But somehow it didn't click with Unbridled. Nothing, then, is ever carved in tablets of stone. That said, there is one light that has always come on.
It must have been 10 days, 2 weeks after my father died. Clay Arnold was stud groom there at the farm. He said, Seth, they tell me you're going to be responsible for all these stallions. You and I better walk through them here and let me tell you what I know about them. So we walk, and most of the time the horse would come over the fence and I'd look at them, and You know, Nijinsky didn't have the best hind leg in the world. Hoist the Flag had a really kind of a hind leg set way out behind him. Buck Pastor was back in the knee. I'm like, well, I ain't, you know. The one thing that I did see in all of them, most, they had good short cannon bones. And I know when Dr. Cheney was vetting a lot of yearlings here, we got to talking about it, and he'd say, you know, I've got to, when I'm x-raying these horses' knees, he said, I'll go into a stall, and if I got to raise that thing up to x-ray his knee, then I'm pretty sure that ain't going to be no count. Well, I thought about what he said. I'm like, well, if he's raising it up, he's got to have a long cannon bone. So maybe that short cannon bone, there is something to that. And if you think about it, when they stride, it's easier for them to break over, you know, and stride again if they've got a short cannon bone. That's the big common denominator that I would really look for.
Regardless, each of the great Claiborne families is the work of generations.
It's probably been a garden that's been cultivated and weeded and watered and had everything bred to the best stallions you can breed them to. You know, that's all the people at Claiborne Farm do. I mean, we're not in the restaurant business. We don't play the stock market. We play the horses, and not betting on them, but, you know, betting our reputation on them for sure. And it's what I, you know, we live on the farm. We're there 24/7. There's no absentee ownership to it. And that's what I always did. And, you know, it looks like hopefully what Walker, my son's going to do.
When appointed farm president in 2014, his son was only a little older than had been Hancock when himself handed the reins. The one big difference scarcely needs stating.
Well, people, when I made that decision, they said, Seth, you sure you know what you're doing? He's awful young. I said, you know, I don't want to listen to that young crap. I said, he's a year older than I was when I started. Plus, I will still be around, and my father wasn't. He doesn't rely on me much. He doesn't need to because he knows what he's doing. But I think in the back of his mind, knowing, well, you know, if something happens here, I can always go ask him what I need to do, then I think that's probably comforting. At least I hope it is.
And what was true for Hancock is also true of Walker.
Well, I was born into it, and I was around there all my life. I mean, I never really knew anything else. So, you know, people come there, and they tell you that the place is dripping with history, and it's moving for other folks probably more so than me, because it's always been there. And I mean, my grandfather started Claiborne Farm in Kentucky back in 1910, and my father built it into what it was and hopefully still is. And I've just been somebody that's maintained it or tried to maintain it. You know, I don't feel that I've had much to do with it other than just keeping it going.